And I'll do a brief introduction welcoming you all to the IRP IoT consolidation call on the 9th of February, 2021 at 1900 UTC. The meeting is recorded. Please state your name when speaking for the record and have your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking. Attendance is taken from Zoom room and I'm turning the call over to Susan. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So this is the consolidation subteam. I don't really view myself as in charge of this one particularly. I'm happy to manage a queue if we need one, but I think we're a small group, and so let's see how it goes. If it's unmanageable for people to just kind of speak up, then we'll revert and start using hands and managing a queue. But you know, there's really only a sort of handful of us, so I think we can have more of a discussion as long as that doesn't mean that, you know, one person is sort of never getting an opportunity to speak and wants to. It's a while since we've had a call. We were working through a whole list of questions that Liz had posed to us, and we'd really got to the point of the sort of final couple of questions about the amicus role or the amicus participation. And I'm trying to find my email. I mean, they were essentially around, let me just pause and I will quickly look. Sort of one about, you know, have we got it right in terms of who should participate as an amicus as of right? And secondly, sort of, you know, things like what access to documents and evidence should the amicus in particular have. Actually, I think these were questions that had come up on general discussion, so I'm not sure that they were. I think these weren't particularly the ones from Liz's email, but they've all been kind of consolidated together. And then we've obviously had a bit of discussion raised sort of by Helen about, you know, have we got the sort of nature of the amicus role right? And indeed, you know, is it an amicus role or is it something different to that? Some sort of greater level of participation envisaged. So I think those are our sort of outstanding issues. Hopefully you've had an opportunity to at least look at some of the materials that Bernard circulated for us, which were looking back at the sort of history of how we ended up with the clause as it currently sits in the interim rules. It's huge. And I confess, I wish I could say I've read all 150 pages. I confess I haven't. But I think the first 20 or so, which are pulling out the particularly salient comments from various emails and transcripts of meetings, I think are helpful as a minimum. And I know sort of Sam and Liz and others have particular views. I know obviously Helen does as well. I will just say, whilst it's kind of fresh in my mind, I've just sort of reread that first 20 pages again in the advance of this call. And the sense I got, and obviously I wasn't a member of that group, so I am basically going off the extracts, is that the group did have in mind that there are different, you know, that there's a that intervention or participation as an intervener was a very different level of participation to intervention as an amicus. And so there were discussions around things like whether the amicus should ever have to contribute costs. If they sort of found themselves effectively on the losing side, and you know, there were the discussion turned to how this was not, you know, that wouldn't normally be what happened with an amicus participant. There was a comment quite late on from Greg about two very different statuses, and viewing the intervener as someone who'd meet the standard to be a party, and viewing the amicus as something different to that and much less than that. And yes, there'd been some discussion early on about whether there should be kind of costs awards against an amicus, for example. And it was felt that that was, you know, not appropriate because they're not a party and they're not, you know, they've got a limited role. Similarly, about whether amicus should get, should have any kind of right to be engaged in any settlement discussions. And again, it was, you know, after some debate on this, it seems to me that the view came out that, that's not the role of an amicus. They're not a party. They're someone who's got something to say in the proceedings, but, you know, the weight that's given to what they have to say depends on how persuasive it is. And they're not, you know, a full participant in the dispute. And so just from reading, as I say, from my quick rereading of the kind of history of how we got to where we got to with the current version of the rule, it feels to me like the IoT group were very much envisaging the kind of traditional amicus role, if you like, rather than something more than that. But this is probably a good point for me to kind of pause and let others have their say, because I know, you know, this has come up because, you know, obviously Helen in particular has commented that that's not necessarily the view taken in the IRP that she's got some experience of.
Yeah, Susan, I will just say that I think the point that I was trying to make sort of slices it even finer to say that, of course, an amicus would not have the same status as a full party, as an intervener, because an amicus doesn't have a claim against ICANN. But I do think there are situations where an amicus's rights can be affected, and they're not merely a viewer or an observer of the proceedings, such that you would find in a traditional definition. And so I would just say that in consideration of that view, and of the fact that, you know, we would want to be careful of rolling over the due process rights of a party whose rights are implicated by these types of proceedings, I wonder if this group kind of thought about that particular issue.
Yeah. This is Sam.
You're thinking carry on, Sam.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Susan.
No, I was just going to say it's sort of helpful, I think, to think in specific examples, perhaps, of what we're trying to safeguard against. So your feeling, I think, would be, Helen, that if, for example, you are one of these cases where, let's take one of the examples that's set out for an amicus. You know, you were a person or an entity that was part of a contention set, and so your feeling in terms of perhaps you were the one who was successful in how that contention set got resolved, then the challenge to that by one or more of the other contention set members, you know, obviously impacts you, because if successful, that reverses, you know, your win, if you like.
Right.
I mean, I see that. But I do, you know, I do wonder, you know, is the IRP process really intended to be a kind of full dispute between the parties? It certainly wasn't intended to be that. Is that really what it's intended to be now?
Yeah, and I don't have the answer to that, and I'd be interested in hearing what maybe Sam had to say.
Thanks, Susan and Helen. You know, so the IRP is clearly by its terms about whether or not ICANN violated its bylaws. And so, you know, I if you look at the item I sent to the IoT list last week, you know, people who come to an IRP really have to kind of take a position. Either ICANN violated its bylaws in the action that's being challenged, or ICANN didn't. And it's not that ICANN violated its bylaws as to one person, but didn't violate its bylaws under the action as to another person. And, you know, so the IRP isn't a place where any relief can be granted as between other parties, or really for ICANN to even be told that it has to undo a decision. The IRP says, comes out with a declaration as to whether or not ICANN violated its bylaws or mission or articles, but it doesn't say, it doesn't require a specific outcome, right? So then what happens is the board goes back and looks at what happened and says, okay, you know, do I need to run the process again? What do I need to do, right? And so all the things that are tethered in here go to the timing issues that we're talking about, right? If they're talking about undoing things. But on the other hand, you know, it, you can see in the deliberations from the IoT and, you know, I have that there's something to what Helen's been saying that also really sticks out to me, right? As you saw during the fact that we have this amicus as of right, that there are people who, there is no discretion by the panelists if these, if entities can come in and say a yes or no to who they might support, right? And so there's a world of parties identified there, right? Those are the contention sets because that's based off of the primary use cases that we've seen for IRPs, but also that idea of someone who's some party who is, or an entity that's named a lot in the proceedings and the record is up to date. And that's to make sure that that entity has the ability to come in and impact the record in the event that they need to. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're able to ask for relief or ask for a different outcome, but I think that we have this risk and I and it continues, right? So IRP proceedings, while you don't have a lot of the documentation or records of the hearings that get put out publicly, all the briefs, other than items that are authorized to be redacted, are made public. The declarations are made public. And there is a risk that parties to an IRP will make misstatements about other entities that are not part of the IRP. And I think it's really important, and it's not just about misstatements, but I think misstatements are one of those times where it's really important to make sure that we have an avenue for those people impacted by those statements to come in and correct a record, right? It could be that you're a public company, like the company that Helen is with, that has, you know, these misstatements on record that could impact their shareholder value, right? But it could be something a lot less, you know, balance inducing than that, or balance impacting. But still, there should be some avenue that people can come in and at least say, hey, you keep talking about me. Here are the facts about what I did and what I didn't do. And so I think one of our questions is, you know, is that enough of a use case? Is the allowance for amicus where you don't have, knowing the limits of the IRP and knowing that it can't be the place where rights are determined as between parties, is that enough or isn't it? And what else would be enough? And what other use cases are we seeing where we think that people need the ability to come in and at least put their hand up in the proceeding to say yes or no, and where that should be left to the discretion of the panelists and we're not. And maybe there's some other opportunity for us to give some more description in the supplementary procedures about what types of discretion on participation we anticipate the panel to have as it relates to an amicus. Should it just be the ability to put in a brief, or should they have more? You know, maybe we can give some guidance that way. That might be one solve instead of creating a whole new terminology of participation within an IRP. So those are just some thoughts I had.
Right, just to seize on your last point, and I think I am actually in agreement with most of what you said. I think, you know, the procedure can lead to maybe a result that ends up overlooking a party, which was maybe unintentional. And so I think my suggestion of changing the terminology was a sort of suggestion to sort of to cover a situation, a suggestion where maybe you could build into the rules a sort of flexibility about the degree of participation to the extent that it's necessary to fully protect the rights and interests of whatever party in that particular situation. And depending on how appropriate it is for their participation to be either, you know, full or mere sort of correction of the record. So I do think we are in agreement on many of those points.
I do think it's important to understand what we'd mean by full participation if a party or if an entity is not a party, because that's a really important limitation to understand so that we can evaluate if that type of full participation would be aligned with the IRP or not.
Right. So then I guess that opens the question to, if you had a party who felt that their rights were going to be very strongly implicated by the IRP, but they were not interested in becoming an intervener such that they didn't feel that they had a position against ICANN and whether ICANN violated their bylaws, but that they felt that their rights would be, I'm just kind of thinking out loud about, you know, the most participation that you could feel that you needed. Do you think that, short of, you know, alleging a claim against ICANN, is there a level of participation that an amicus could have that is nearly equal to a party? Is that appropriate under the bylaws or not? And I'm just kind of thinking about, you know, what that would look like.
So my first reaction to that is we have to really step back and look at what that other party is hoping to achieve if they're not making a claim against ICANN, because then we sit back and we say, okay, so what happens in an IRP? We have, unless the claim itself is brought with bad purpose or, you know, whatever's laid out in the bylaws, ICANN is funding the panel, right? So that means the ICANN community is funding the resources that go to this and paying for that, you know, so where is the place for the ICANN community or that broader aspect of how we use resources within an IRP? You know, are we funding to an extent someone's ability to come in, not just put their hand up and say, hey, I'm correcting the record, but also come in and say, hey, you should be considering all these other things, and we want the ability to participate a lot, and which we're going to add to the panel time, we're going to add to the extent of the process, but we're not actually going to seek, you know, any sort of relief. We're not really joining it for that part. You know, where's the propriety line for that? I think we have to keep in mind that overarching intent of the IRP as we look at how we make sure people have the ability to come in and put their hand up and correct a record or put their hand up for purposes. You know, where's that line between putting a hand up and almost full participation? Because almost full participation can still exponentially increase the cost amount for an IRP and also increase the amount of time the IRP takes. So I don't have the answer. I'm just raising the question.
Right, that's true. And then also, you know, the result in that type of situation can really affect, like as Susan was saying, with the contention set and challenging a decision of ICANN to award a TLD, for example, can very much implicate the entire rights of a party who sort of had really no ability to speak in their defense, to support ICANN's defense, overturn arguments that were made by the challenging party, except to sort of be able to raise their hand and correct the record, right? So that's the situation that I would be thinking of in particular.
Dina?
Yeah, and I will fully confess that I have not had a chance to go back and listen to the recording from our last meeting. And I'd also only made it through the first 20 to 30 pages of this transcript. A couple observations in terms of where I am, where my head is at right now on this. First, I certainly do see the need for some kind of mechanism to address a situation in which a third, I hate to use the word party because I don't want to confuse this, but a third party that is not a party to the IRP believes that in connection with the notice of the IRP or the conduct of the IRP, that either of the parties, and I think it would most likely be the claimant, has mischaracterized its position or statements, et cetera. I think that's a separate kind of sui generis thing. And I do think that we need to have a narrow and efficient mechanism for dealing with that. But I am very concerned that not to be kind of trite about it, but I have this nightmare scenario of opening up the floodgates and you have IRPs, which are already horrifically expensive, becoming even more expensive and taking longer to resolve and more complicated. And I keep coming back to, in my head at least, the scenario that we kept hearing about, or at least that seems to kind of keep popping up in this, the chronological history doc, or the first 20 pages of it, is a scenario in which there is either a contention set or some type of objection in, you know, whether it's a legal rights objection or whatever, and the losing party files an IRP, and what mechanism is there for the winning party. And I guess what I'm really struggling with is I don't understand, again, setting aside the narrow need to correct misstatements made about that prevailing party. I'm not really quite sure why I'm having a hard time justifying why that winning party should have an opportunity, because as a practical matter, I can't come up with a scenario in which in defending the IRP that ICANN isn't going to basically be making the same arguments that this third party would be making, right? Because in such an IRP, let's just say a contention set or like legal rights objection, that might be easier at least for me to get my head around. The losing party in the legal rights objection files the IRP saying that the process violated its bylaws. As a practical matter, in defending that IRP and in defending the outcome and in defending the basic core argument that this legal rights objection did not, in fact, ICANN did not violate its bylaws, I don't understand where there would be room or an opportunity for there to be a separate position that wouldn't already be basically encompassed by what ICANN is going to do in defending this, as a practical matter, in defending this IRP. Because this third party, their position ultimately is no, ICANN didn't violate its bylaws, or ICANN didn't take action that's inconsistent with its bylaws. So I don't know. I think it would be helpful for for folks who do understand where that kind of scenario, where you could have a scenario, and then maybe it's like a Venn diagram, is help me understand what interest this potential amicus would have in this legal rights objection based IRP, where ICANN itself wouldn't already be addressing those issues. And I think that's what I keep struggling with, is that until I can really understand the problem we're actually really trying to solve, I'm having a hard time wanting to justify this potentially extraordinarily expansive amicus opportunity. Thanks.
Thanks, Christina. If you don't mind, I'll just quickly leap in as well. And I think that was where I was coming from. And where, having, as I said, sort of reviewed the extracts of transcripts and so on, where I felt that the group had come to, I mean, maybe they didn't, they perhaps didn't have the conversation in quite the same form, but they, you know, I think they were very, very clearly having discussions about whether you should or shouldn't be a party or not. And there might be circumstances where you need to make some submissions, but you don't qualify as a party, and therefore, okay, well, we've got the amicus role. And I suppose just to add to your question that you posed, mine would be, what is it about the amicus role anyway that doesn't give you the right to make your argument? Not just to correct a record, in fact, but, you know, isn't it quite commonly the case that in outside of an IRP scenario, you know, where a group like the American Bar Association or INTA or someone is intervening in a particular piece of litigation, you know, they're putting in their brief where they're making all of their legal arguments and you know, explaining why whichever position they're taking is the one that should be taken. And so what is it about this process that we think doesn't already allow for that, even, you know, within the construct of the typical amicus role? I mean, what we're really saying is, or I think what I'm hearing is, if it were to go further, what are we expecting them to get that they can't do already? And it would have to be sort of almost opportunities to what? To challenge witnesses? Well, I don't think we even really have that for the parties. Or, you know, opportunities to respond to something else that someone's, you know, a submission that someone else has made. Well, I think, again, I think they don't, they have that ability anyway, provided obviously that the panelist thinks that what they're submitting is appropriate and okay, gives it the weight that they give it. But I'm not clear what they're missing in the amicus construct. But it might be because I'm not sufficiently close to how things panned out. And I'm not seeing what the issue is, I guess.
So Susan, I can try to tell you about my experience, and I think I'll take the second part of your question first. I think part of the problem is that the procedures officer's duties are sufficiently unclear so that in some cases they feel that they have either the leeway or lack of leeway to even decide whether an amicus who has been a quote unquote party to the events can make a decision one way or the other, and perhaps can even exclude the participation of the quote unquote party that feels that their rights may be violated and want to be heard. So Sam, I see that you're saying that one of the goals is to clarify the procedures officer role. And so if everything goes the way that perhaps this group intends, then I think that would be fine. I think to talk specifically about the Afilias IRP, there were hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on briefing and convincing and discussing with the procedures officer the scope of the amicus participation and whether the amicus should be allowed to participate at all. So I think that there can be, within the scope of these rules, some a lack of clarity around whether an amicus can participate at all based on the procedures officer. On your initial point and Christina's point of why allow more participation by an amicus when ICANN would be coming to their own defense, I think you might draw a parallel, and maybe this is the wrong parallel, but to the court system where there is an existing lawsuit and say there's a third party or intervener who would like to make statements and arguments on their own behalf because they feel their rights are implicated. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are filing a suit against the plaintiff. I think they are allowed to have a degree of participation that doesn't mean that they are intervening in order to affect the litigation against the plaintiff, but in fact, to come to their own defense. So am I being too kind of not specific enough? But
can you repeat that last part of that for me, Helen? I didn't quite get it.
I was just drawing a parallel to the court system where simply because a party is joining in a litigation case, it doesn't mean that they are, the way that this is set up is an intervener is also filing or joining in some claim against ICANN, right? But if you had a litigation matter, if a intervener joined and was going to sort of make arguments and write briefs defending their actions that were implicated by the case, it wouldn't necessarily mean that they were bringing a claim against the plaintiff. So I guess, and it also doesn't mean that either of the parties would necessarily be able to completely have access to the locus of facts that involves such a party and that any sort of litigation would be helped by additional facts, additional defense, and to make sure to protect the due process rights of such a party who was interested in making sure that their positions were heard. Does that make sense?
Sorry, I'm on mute. Sort of. Sam's got a hand up, so I think I'll
just thinking it through out loud, and so it might not be completely crystallized.
I guess my question goes back to some of the base conversation we were having and some of the questions that Christina was posing earlier, which is, what is the value and purpose of that other entity coming in to defend their actions other than to correct a record when an IRP is about whether or not ICANN violated its actions, right? So it's not about the other party's actions that need to be defended. It's about whether or not ICANN can defend the steps that it took to be in line with the bylaws.
Right. That's the nexus
I'm missing.
Right. It is about what ICANN did, but you have to admit that the end effect of what the panel's decision is may affect not just the parties that are involved in the IRP and may significantly affect the rights of parties other than those who are directly involved in the IRP.
It may affect, and I think that's one of the natural outcomes of any IRP, is that ICANN being told that its action has to be redone in some way or refigured always can impact someone other than the person who's making the claim. And, you know, so the IRPs have always been about winners and losers I'm not trying to be a pejorative, but that's really what it's about, right? Someone got something they wanted and someone didn't get something that they wanted. That's been the common use case around IRPs. And so that's always been the case. But then I always go back to that fundamental question of, if ICANN actually violated its bylaws in taking that action, whether or not the other party is upset about that ruling or has something that they have some benefit of taken away or potentially taken away because of that ruling. Because remember, the declaration of an IRP doesn't mean that ICANN goes, like, the panel can't say, okay, party A had their rights violated, so ICANN now has to give it to party A. That's not the outcome of the IRP. The outcome of the IRP is ICANN, you violated your bylaws and how you did it. Go think about how you did it and maybe do it over in a way that doesn't violate your bylaws. So it doesn't actually foretell any outcome. And so that's why we need to focus on that's one of the reasons why when we're talking about those issues of repose and timing, that timing issue is so important, because then you're not dealing with a party who's had 5 years of operating a TLD that now has it up for consideration, right? We want these things to be brought up in real time, to be brought up before people have vested, you know, tens of thousands or millions of dollars in acting upon an ICANN decision they believe was final. And so that's why timing is such an important component of this, because it does affect third parties. And so, you know, that's where these things come together, that someone else's, you know, something that someone else wants will be impacted by an IRP in almost every case, and at least in every case that we've had so far. And so how do we make sure that with that reality, they are just and not, but without adding so much procedure or time or cost to make it, you know, so expensive for both the claimants and to the ICANN ecosystem.
I understand that broadening it could very much broaden it to a lot of different claims that are problematic. But I do think that if there is a party in the contention set example who is claiming that their rights could be violated by the decision, and yet, you know, participating in the IRP more than just to correct the record could be something that ends up protecting their, sorry, you're saying rights impacted or rights violated. So I said part rights violated because you said rights violated. So I wasn't meaning anything specific by my phrasing. But I do think that perhaps we could think about, you know, a level of participation appropriate to how a party's interests might be affected by the outcome.
So I think that comes back to one of the questions that I'd asked, though, which is, it doesn't, I mean, an obvious role for the amicus, or an obvious thing that an amicus would want to do, and a reason why we would give access, you know, access to an amicus to participate in the proceedings is to correct the record. Am I incorrect in thinking that an amicus could just as easily be participating, and they're not quite correcting a record because they're not specifically pointing out, you know, falsehoods that they feel one of the other parties has put forward, but essentially to be putting forward their take on why the decision is right. And so their sort of, you know, their view of the facts and circumstances, to ensure that the panel have that in front of them. Albeit that, as Christina said, you'd like to think that the party that's actually defending this, ICANN, would be making those same arguments anyway, but let's assume that for some reason they wouldn't be making all of them. Is it not perfectly within the scope of the amicus role for them to do that anyway? I mean, the amicus isn't surely just about correcting the record, is it?
I agree with you, Susan. I think that's another fully appropriate role for an amicus, right? To set out their position, but not to actually require, get so involved unless the panel for some reason decides to take it up to make that its own separate part of the proceedings.
Well, I guess the question is whether it's explicitly stated that that level of participation is appropriate or not, or whether it's stated that that level, even that level of appropriate participation is not appropriate. So, right, part of my argument is that an amicus should be allowed a level of participation appropriate to how its interests might be affected by the outcome, and advocating for some level of flexibility. And I guess the question is, perhaps because my understanding, and it could be an incorrect understanding, is that I'm not sure whether the rules or the bylaws are open to that approach. And maybe if that's the case, is it reasonable to make that more clear? Instead of being sort of subject to interpretation by parties who also don't know if that's clear or not.
Sam.
Thanks, Susan. So I think that we have the ability, if it's not already in there, to clarify the discretion that rests within a procedures officer, not the procedures officer, but whoever's making the decision about people coming in. But also, you know, we have the amicus participation as of right. I haven't really heard any discussion that we would change that test at all. That is something we should just confirm we're okay with, right? But if someone, if an entity has been identified as an entity that it makes sense to allow them to come into the IRP in some way, shape, or form, procedures officer or whatever that new role, whatever we call it and however we better frame it, because we all agree that was not a good experience in the Aphilius IRP, they have discretion in how they allow that amicus to come in. But I don't think that I would highly recommend against putting in a test that says that the participation of the amicus should be tested against the materiality of the rights they're trying to assert. Because I think one of the things we still want to avoid is creating new opportunities to impact the IRP through additional motions or brief writing, right? Because then the fight is, you know, is it material enough for me to come in this way versus not in this other way? And so I think having a line of discretion, but not necessarily allowing the IRP to get sidetracked to a fight about what level is appropriate in each one, that's where I think from the ICANN side, we'd want to see the line drawn, because that again is another opportunity to really impact the length of the proceedings, particularly when you're keeping in mind whether or not someone has some sort of right that they wish to preserve or something that they wish to state, that still goes against what the ultimate value can be when we look back at the limited nature of the IRP.
Thanks, Sam. I mean, that does seem to make sense to me. I mean, I think we've already talked about the need for some clarity on the role of who's making the decision, which I think we've already kind of dealt with or will have dealt with. We don't have new language, but we've dealt with it. I think perhaps it's not it's maybe not as absolutely clear that the paragraphs 1 to 3 in the current draft rules, in that paragraph in the clause that I numbered 21, that there are participants who can participate as of right. I mean, I think that's the intent. I'm not sure it's absolutely clear that that's what we're saying. And so I think that might be an area where there could be sort of inconsistent approach by the panelists, because and I'm deferring to you if in fact this wasn't the intent, but it seems to me the intent was that was provided you were one of those three classes of person, you know, you were meant to really be able to participate as an amicus as of right. And so that there may be a discretion about how much participation you're given or whatever, but there wasn't a dispute about letting you in. I had added a fourth one as a suggestion, but I think we have talked about that briefly, and I think it wasn't necessarily getting the level of support. The fourth one that I'd added was sort of another one as of right, but the comment had been, well, there's always a discretion to include a party like that. So do we really think we need to add them as of right? But so it seems to me that if we perhaps tighten that language up a bit, to make sure that it's absolutely clear that those three paragraphs are as of right, and that, you know, there's a discretion for others to persuade the procedures officer. I'm using that term because, you know, that's what we've still got in the draft. You know, to persuade them to let someone else in as an amicus, then I think that goes quite a long way. And what else do we have to think about? Level of participation. I mean, do we put something in? There's already provision in there that says the panel should be sort of erring towards sort of, you know, the highest level of participation, if you like, you know, sort of. So there's already something that anticipates that they won't be too constraining about what they allow. Yeah, sorry. Brenda, you could use, if you can find it, the Rule 7 Markup 3 it should be okay if you can find that one, which was circulated. We've circulated it a couple of times, but before the last call that we had, I think I circulated it again, because that's a version of the rules, but then with some, you know, markup where I was suggesting edits, but it's pretty obvious what the changes are. Shall I see if I can?
Give me 1 second.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find the date. So 22nd of December actually is probably as good a place as any to find it. Shall I forward it to you again?
Nope. How does this look? Well, hold on. Ooh. I don't look like what I meant to show. Hold on. This one?
No, I think it was the other one.
Really? Okay, hold on. This says it is.
Yeah. I think that's it. And then the bit about the amicus is towards the end.
Okay.
wonder if that's not the right one. I don't know, but I think that is right.
This is called Rule 7 Markup 3.
Yeah, I think this is fine.
My apologies.
Let me forward it to you. Because sure. I think I put paragraph numbers in just to make it easier for us.
Okay.
Oh, perhaps that is it. Actually, I think that is it.
Yeah, I think that's
right. So do you want this paragraph, Amicus? I know that's hard to read. I'll increase the size here. View. So there are line numbers if you are.
Yeah. Yes, so it starts, the section about the amicus starts just about paragraph 21. That's it, yes. Yeah, and then if you don't mind scrolling down that, the 1 to 3, exactly. Yeah, this bit just coming up is the classes of people who have participation as of right. Is this helping, Helen? It's not easy to display very much of it.
It does. Thank you. And my apologies for slowing things down.
And just a note, as we're looking at this, I think we learned from some of the proceedings around the Afilius IRP is that we should get clearer on what we mean by the underlying proceeding. That text was not necessarily clear to the panel, as I understand it. I was, full disclosure, I was a witness in that, and I was questioned on that language. So I think that we have some places where we can maybe update this language to be a little bit clearer about what we mean. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend any other wholesale changes to the amicus as of right without some further discussion about a new category.
And what do we mean by the underlying proceeding?
Yeah, I think that we kind of inartfully put that in, you know, we were drafting many different things at many different times. One of the use cases for the IRP, or one of the significant use cases that we've seen, is coming out of the new GTLD program, that people who lost among, who were not successful at one of the panel level issues. So we had, as Christina mentioned, we had legal rights objections, we had other types of objections, we had community priority. You know, we had other places where there was, for lack of a better term, some sort of proceeding where, you know, rights were measured as against each other, and someone either lost a right to participate in a string in a special way or was taken out of a contention set. So that's kind of what we meant by underlying proceeding, but we didn't use the right words there. And so there was some questioning on that part. I think we would benefit by making that clearer, maybe by reference to language out of an applicant book guidebook or something from the subsequent procedures work that's going on, but something to make it. Because it wasn't clear, but who had had some sort of dispute or proceeding within the IRP or within the new G program that then led up to why they brought the decision.
Understood. Because I was going to just try and look at that section in the bylaws, but I don't know if that's going to shed that much light.
No, I think we actually use some of the same language in the bylaws itself. Let me pull up my copy, but you know, we'll take a look. I think this is a place where we can make some quick changes from the IoT side just to make this a little bit more specific and to reduce some of the panel interpretation around it, so we don't have a fight as to whether or not someone's part of an underlying proceeding or not.
Yeah.
Because again, that's the purpose of having some people, some entities identified as of right, so that you don't necessarily have to have a briefing, right? It's something you can just kind of tell by looking at it that they belong there. And then we reserve the cases that aren't as prima facie to then have the panel use its discretion, or whichever part of the panel we're using, use their discretion on whether or not that party should come in as an amicus.
I'm just typing in what it's, I think it's the same, effectively the same language that's in that bylaws provision that's quoted. It just talks about resulted from decisions of a process specific expert panel. Again, I mean, it doesn't seem that unclear.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's a lot clearer in the bylaws than it is in the procedures, but it was clearly painful moment to be questioned on this part.
Yeah. So, okay, so is that something you can suggest some tweaks to, Sam?
Yeah, definitely, we'll take that on.
Briefings, okay. Okay, and I mean, and presumably that paragraph one would pick up things like, I don't know, like a legal rights objection and a challenge to the, you know, there's a winner and, to use your terminology, there's a winner and a loser in that, and the loser could be the one bringing an IRP. And so the winner in that scenario would be picked up by one, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then in any event, even if it was something like, again, it's easiest to think about new GTLD program ones, just because that's what I'm so familiar with. But you know, if there was someone felt that the evaluation of a particular string had been woefully inadequate, and they're somehow impacted because the result of that means that they're now in contention with that string that they think shouldn't have been, you know, shouldn't have passed evaluation. I'm not sure that they.
That would depend on whether or not there any were of experts those, involved. But
they'd be one of the ones that would be a discretionary one, wouldn't they?
Yeah, it depends on which evaluation is being discussed. So like the community priority evaluation likely would be something that would fall in, because that there was an expert panel that reviewed CPE as to each entity that claimed it, right? But if it was, you know, maybe the financial evaluation or one of the other, you know, more basic aspects, maybe those wouldn't fall into a process specific expert panel. Right, I'm just trying to think about, you know, the years old memories of how this was developed. So there could be some that, you know, if you're challenging ICANN's determination of a certain level of readiness versus an expert panel, that's maybe where that line would be, but there'd still be the opportunity to apply for discretionary. Or if someone, like, the other side of it is, if someone thinks that, you know, Sam's company who applied for, you know, whatever string shouldn't have gotten the string, and they say that they were harmed by Sam's company getting the string, then if they keep talking about Sam's company enough, then I'm going to fall into, if the briefings significantly refer to actions taken by a person, group, or entity that's external to the dispute. So Sam's company already comes in as a amicus as of right under that, even if it wasn't out of a process, even if the IRP itself wasn't challenging an expert panel.
Because it's kind of, it's all about them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, and confess I've lost the bit that talks about the level of participation. Ooh. No, I can't find that bit. Am I misremembering? Maybe it's just that I can't. Maybe I just can't find it.
Which part are you looking for, Susan?
Well, I thought that there was somewhere, something in there that talked about sort of allowing wide participation, sort of erring on the side of sort of giving them
So that's in the footnote. There's a footnote to it. It says during the pendency of these interim supplementary rules and exercising discretion and allowing participation of amicus curiae, the panel shall lean in favor of allowing broad participation as needed to further the purposes of the IRP.
Thank you. I knew I'd seen it somewhere. And what is the purpose of that as a footnote? Was that just included as a footnote to kind of, because these were viewed as interim rules and you didn't want to exclude people?
If I recall, I think that's right. We wanted to make sure that we weren't taking exclusionary steps to keep people out of the proceedings during the pendency of the interim procedures. And if I recall, there was some argument for, you know, making sure we stated the preference for broad participation. And then we, as the next iteration of the IOT, you know, if we chose to move language like this up into the main part of the procedures, we surely could. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like that might be another way of addressing the concerns that Helen had without going so far as to just, completely develop a whole new set of kind of intervener statuses, but just the sort of, you know, to the extent that there's a discretion that we're suggesting the panel kind of err on the side of inclusiveness. Does that sound reasonable, Helen? Or was that language in itself part of the issue?
I am looking for the footnote, actually. During the pendency of these interim rules, IRP panel shall lean in favor of broad. Right. So, I mean, it's limited just to the interim rules, but I think that is certainly helpful, Susan.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'd have to obviously, if we'd be taking out the, the during the pendency bit.
Right.
Yeah, and it looks like, Sam, it looks like you're agreeing that it seems reasonable to move it up. So, okay. Shall we go on to think about sort of access to documents, which is, I'd sort of inserted some suggested language, and because this was kind of a straw person version of the text, which is in the paragraph that's the last one, basically number 25, I think is what it's numbered. Yes, pause. I think, I mean, we have, in any event, we have materials in the dispute are made available generally. You know, they're published on ICANN's website, aren't they? Except where there's some kind of a confidentiality element.
So documents exchanged between parties, if there are documents exchanged, or, you know, exhibits and stuff might not always be available unless there's a, unless they had been attached to a witness statement or something. So, you know, there are provisions within the supplementary procedures that allow for some level of discovery, and we don't have a requirement that items that are exchanged pursuant to that are made public. So there could very well in every IRP be information that's exchanged as between the parties that isn't recorded in a brief, or a request to the panel that wouldn't itself be, you know, published on the ICANN website.
Okay. But it would be if it was actually referenced in a witness statement?
Yeah, so unless there are confidentiality considerations, and Liz, come in if I'm recalling this incorrectly, unless there are confidentiality considerations, you know, a filing that's made to the IRP, and we often do have filings that have, you know, exhibits attached to them and things, you know, those typically get put up just as they're filed. But that's not an assurance that every piece of information that's exchanged between ICANN and a claimant is made available or considered for withholding, because they don't, they're, as far as I understand, and this is where some of the limitation from me, like I'm no longer an active, you know, practitioner in the IRP space. I don't think that there's a consideration of each item that's exchanged to go up on the website. It would have to be something that was part of a filing.
Okay. But then if those materials were going to be referred to the panel, and there was an expectation that the panel would be giving mind to them and perhaps referencing them in their decision, then presumably they would then become part of the kind of public record, wouldn't they?
So IRPs are a little bit different than reconsiderations, where reconsideration is expected to only be taken on the basis of a public record. IRPs are allowed to be taken even in consideration of confidential information, and the panel considers the scope of holding back information as part of their declaration. And then I know that we have both Christina and Liz's hands up, so I'll stop talking and let them.
Okay, Christina.
Yeah, so just to kind of add in from the perspective of someone who's been through this, I mean, this is actually one of the parts of this rule that gives me, from that perspective, kind of the greatest heartburn. There were, you know, in any IRP, I would expect it. Well, without getting into too much information and making disclosures that I can't make, there certainly is the possibility in an IRP for documents to be exchanged between the claimant and ICANN pursuant to a confidentiality order. And it's also entirely possible that that confidentiality order may have multiple tiers. For example, there may be documents that the claimant's lawyers and ICANN's lawyers can see, but that the claimant representatives and ICANN representatives cannot, for example. And the idea that we would, notwithstanding those arrangements, if they have been made between ICANN and the claimant, that we would then give the panel kind of unfettered, potentially unfettered discretion to decide that those arrangements may not apply to an amicus, I think is really problematic. It would seem to me that at a minimum, what we would want to do is, if we are going to give the panel some discretion to allow the amicus to have access to any of the documents, that it would have to be on subject to confidentiality provisions that are no less lenient or, you know, no less strict than what is already in place between ICANN and the claimant. And in fact, I can certainly envision a scenario in which you could have the claimant and the amicus are actually competitors, that you would actually want, and I think it would really only be fair and appropriate, to have an even higher confidentiality standard between the claimant and the amicus, for example, than you would have between the claimant and ICANN.
Yeah. Yeah, seems fair. Sorry, I forgot you had your hand up as well, Liz. Sorry.
Sure, no problem. I just wanted to add, from an IRP practitioner's standpoint, about documents to what Sam added, and perhaps also address a little bit of what Helen just said. It is correct what Sam said with respect to how documents, what documents are submitted, what documents are reviewed, and what gets published. The IRP panel, and I'm sorry, I meant Christina. The IRP panel does have the discretion and are able to review documents that have been designated as confidential that would not otherwise get published on the website itself, if the panel does mention or reference those documents in those confidential documents in their declaration, then prior to posting, ICANN would go ahead and redact it, and also work with the party in the IRP to make sure that they their concerns that they and the confidentiality that they asserted has been redacted to their satisfaction. And also, there have been times where I think it's up to the party designating the confidential information if they want to go ahead and list that and publish and have it published. So those are just some consideration on redactions and what gets published itself. I think with respect to what Christina is saying, I understand those concerns. Yes, there are, and what she's saying is accurate in terms of the different levels of the confidentiality agreement. They have existed at different levels in past IRPs. I think this goes to what an amicus can and cannot see. It may also have a lot to do with the timing that we were talking about, which is important. It really depends on when, the timing for an amicus. So someone to seek to join as an amicus, because generally the documents and the confidentiality agreements don't actually get decided or put in place until there's a discovery hearing. That's how it's usually happened. Those agreements have actually been put in place when there's some kind of a document production that happens in the IRP initially, if there's documents that are filed in support of a IRP statement. Those at the outset will get designated by the party, the claimant, as confidential or non-confidential. So I think that most of the time, the IRP, the discovery hearings don't happen until after the parties have set underway and there's been some kind of initial hearing with the panelists. So if we have an amicus that is already joined at the outset or shortly thereafter based upon our timing, then I think the considerations of what the amicus should be should or be able to see would be then included in that discovery hearing discussion. Just something for consideration.
Thanks, Liz. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it does leave the amicus potentially, having not seen some documents annexed to a pleading at the earliest stage, because it's been designated as confidential. But presumably there would be nothing to stop them seeking an order for that to be disclosed to them.
Right. Yes. If I can jump in right there, yeah. I think that also goes to Christina's point. I think it's a really good point, which is they shouldn't be allowed to just see all the documents because they might be a competitor of the claimant. So I think that's where there has to be some kind of a showing of why the amicus should be allowed to see certain documents that have otherwise been designated as confidential by either the claimant and or.
Yeah. Okay, so I mean, it sounds as though I think that's sort of what I have been intending by this provision. Certainly, the current version of the rules only talks about, kind of the IRP has the discretion to decide what to make available. And so I had tried to kind of make a distinction between publicly available documents and those which had been designated as confidential. It might be that it needs a bit more tweaking to firm it up and to incorporate that kind of the kind of expectation of a similar sort of level of confidentiality, stringency or confidentiality obligations imposed that Christina was talking about. So it sounds as though we could perhaps firm that up a bit, but sort of it's heading in the right direction and it sounds as though everyone's sort of on the same page on that one. So, I mean, we have a bit more kind of tweaking to do, definitely, and some, I think probably the next stage would be, it would be helpful if I can try and summarize where I think we've got to on all of this and sort of flag where we need some new language or, as a placeholder that we're going to have some new language for some things. But I mean, aside from that, and aside from the need for it to actually be redrafted, I think we're sort of there in this group. Maybe let's see what it looks like and see whether we think we need another call in 2 weeks' time. But perhaps we will if everyone sort of feels happy with it, and we might be at a point where we've got something that we could send back to the full working group. I'm not quite sure. We might need a quick call just to sort of, you know, as a kind of final pass through. Does that sound okay with you all? I'm seeing silence, so I'm hoping I'm going to kind of let's see where we get to. But I think we've covered off a lot of what we wanted to cover. If I try and go through and sort of summarize where we've got to, maybe that will flag if I think we've missed something. We can try and have a final call, and hopefully we can sense check and feel, you know, and double check that we haven't missed anything and that we're all on the same page. Okay, so let's aim for another call in 2 weeks then, in our usual slot. And hopefully that might be the point at which we can wrap this up. Super. Thanks, everyone. Really helpful. I think, you know, I think the working in a smaller group and trying to work in this way, I think it's taken us a bit of time, but I think it is a bit more productive generally than the bigger working group calls, certainly for when you're just trying to sort of bash through some particular issues. So I think this has been a worthwhile exercise. Thanks very much. So we've got our main call this time next week, I think in the earlier time slot probably, and then we'll reconvene in 2 weeks for this consolidation group. Thanks, everyone.